Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. A very famous man, you might have heard of him, Isaac Newton, once said, "An object in motion tends to remain in motion." This is part of the concept of inertia. And we're going to be spending the next 2 weeks talking about institutional inertia. Well, people in power tend to remain in power, especially in scientific institutions. And such people really don't like to be contradicted by new facts or discoveries, unless, of course, they own them. I don't have to tell you, if you're a regular listener, and even if you're not, that COVID has provided a lot of examples of wrong-headed institutional thinking and unwillingness to admit error. And we will get to that next week in a program that also continues to cover the genetics thread of this week, but next week will be in the context of genetics and COVID-19. But first, there was big news on the psychedelic therapy front last week, and we'll be discussing the research and the institutional politics of that on this week's Ask Dr. Dawn as our focus segment. We'll also have some interesting email. Did a psychedelic experience change your life? Should we open Pandora's box? Or do people already have enough problems distinguishing reality from fantasy? And of course, we'll have some science, including a new way of looking at how genes interact and the emerging functional approach to dealing with the genetic hand we were dealt. So we start responding to an email that we received about psilocybin and MDMA and using that for treating PTSD. So I'm not going to bother to read the email. It included a link to a very good New York Times article and a link to the press release by the Interdisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, who did the research. And there's an interesting backstory there, which we'll be getting to fairly soon. First, let's start with PTSD and what's going on with that. So there are a lot of clinical criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder, and we're going to discuss some of them. They may be familiar to you to a greater or lesser degree. The first one is avoidance of stimulation. The second is guilt and shame about the event which occurred. People with PTSD are always on guard, always sort of hypervigilant. They have a loss of interest in activities that used to interest them, and they have difficulty sleeping. So what would MDMA do here? Well, that's ecstasy, and it is effectively a really powerful drug that causes the brain to release two hormones, prolactin and oxytocin. And that may be familiar to you because the familiar oxytocin is the thing that causes letdown. When a mother cradles her baby, she experiences love and her breasts relax and milk is produced. Prolactin is the hormone that starts to go up at the very end of pregnancy and causes the breasts to produce milk. We know from work in birds that prolactin is extremely important for nesting behavior. Even though birds don't produce milk, they do produce baby birds. And prolactin in that particular lineage has a different set of behaviors that it induces in the individual. Oxytocin has been called the love hormone, and it is also released after human orgasm. It's released when a person experiences a feeling of love, or is it the other way around? Do they experience the feeling of love because oxytocin has been released? Or is that, in fact, nothing but a chicken and egg question? MDMA also suppresses the amygdala, and the amygdala is a place in the midbrain that is the equivalent of fear. And I misspoke earlier when I said that ecstasy and MDMA are synonymous. So let me correct myself before someone else does. Moving on to the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies and their research that they've just released, it was a phase 3 trial of using MDMA-assisted therapy for post-traumatic stress syndrome. This study was done in people with severe chronic PTSD. The results were highly significant. We'll talk about the method, but I'm going to give you the highlights at the top here. 67% of the participants who actually received therapy sessions that were assisted by MDMA at the end of the therapy sessions no longer qualified for a diagnosis of PTSD because they had lost those qualifying attributes that I mentioned earlier. And also, remember, we're talking about 100%. So 67% were effectively cured, and 88% experienced what the researchers call a clinically meaningful reduction in symptoms. So that's a 12% non-response rate. There was a placebo group, and the placebo group got the same therapy. They just didn't get the MDMA. And so they had a non-response rate that was about three times that of placebo. The 90 patients treated in this trial had had an average duration of PTSD for 14 years. Many of them were people who had had combat incidents in war, severe accidents, abuse, or sexual harm. 84% of them had a history of developmental trauma, in other words, child abuse of some kind, or loss of a parent in, you know, some sort of horrendous way. In other words, very deep-seated, very early transformational events during the most highly neuroplastic and malleable state there is, which is childhood. And if you're working as a psychotherapist, you could tell me, but I'll tell you because they've told me, that sort of thing is baked in. It's very, very difficult to turn around. This may lead to FDA approval for MDMA in this particular diagnosis. The lead author of the paper is a woman named Jennifer Mitchell, Dr. Jennifer Mitchell. She wanted to underline the fact that the results were really great on people who had comorbidities, that is to say, a history of alcohol or substance abuse, and those who had the dissociative subtype of PTSD. And that's the group that just kind of has checked out, is apathetic, doesn't want to do anything. Because of what MDMA does, it raises your compassion, it raises your understanding, and it tamps down fear. So people who did talk therapy while under the influence were able to make substantial changes deep in their ingrained response pattern in ways that have not been possible before. There were no increase in suicidal thoughts, no increase in suicidal behaviors. One concern that was raised in the trials was whether this would create a cardiovascular risk or abuse potential. There were temporary increases in blood pressure and pulse, similar to what you would get with exercise. And to those of you in my audience who may have taken a psychedelic at some point in your life, muscle tightness, nausea, sweating, and feeling cold were also common side effects. The body effectively gets programmed by these events. The brain gets programmed. And, well, deprogramming may be possible. This opens a door in not just PTSD therapy, but all sorts of trauma-related therapies, and maybe even people with what we call personality disorders or with learned helplessness, other sorts of things that have really twisted them and impaired their ability to live up to their full potential. Now, currently, MDMA is defined by the FDA and the DEA as a Schedule One drug, that is to say a drug with no medical benefit. And I think we can say, and I'm quoting now Rick Doblin, we'll be hearing more about him later, he's the executive director of MAPS, as a result of this study and through the persistent and consistent application of scientific rigor, we have demonstrated that MDMA-assisted therapy is likely to provide relief for people diagnosed from PTSD. Far from having no medical benefit, MDMA, when combined with thought therapy, has the potential to catalyze the therapeutic process and generate positive mental health outcomes. This is really, really a game changer. There's currently a second phase 3 clinical trial going on. They're actually enrolling participants. This is going to also look at PTSD. They have further studies planned looking at other mental health issues. And it's pretty amazing. I've been keeping you up to date on this, I hope, in talking about the use of ketamine for the treatment of depression and addiction. And one of the reasons that therapy has been able to move forward faster is that drug is actually approved as a drug for a human drug with medical benefit. So while we're using it for a different indication, when we use it for psychotherapy, we're using an FDA-approved drug. And that approval process, well, as you can see from just seeing what's happened with getting vaccine approval, it's not an easy task to get approval. So let's go back 40 years. Now we start getting into the institutional issues. 40 years ago, a man named Rick Doblin, who was a pioneering psychedelics researcher, dropped a hit of acid in college and had a life-transforming event and decided to dedicate his life to the healing powers of psychedelics. He has stuck with it in a crusade for 40 years, and for him, this must be the publication of this study in the journal Nature Medicine must be a massive, massive life-changing experience all by itself. It's the step through the door after a walk down a long, dark hallway. In recent years, things have been moving in the psychedelic world. He's watched this change from fringe science to free enterprise-driven investor opportunities. And we'll talk more about that in a second. Not always so great. Michael Pollan, an author I follow quite closely, wrote a book about 3 years ago called How to Change Your Mind, in which he essentially did a series of personal experiments under appropriately guided situations using all of the various psychedelics, and a few I'd never even heard of, and writes about his experience in his usual highly detailed and engaging fashion. So I would recommend that book if you're interested in some firsthand reporter in the street discussions of it. The problem, as I said, is how far will the pendulum swing, and are we going to see a drive to commercialize the drugs? I mean, we can see what's happened with marijuana and how far that pendulum swung and how fast. But that's a drug that's really, really harmless. The question here is, and even then you can get children overdosing on it and ending up in the ER, so it's not without its risks, particularly an overdose. But when we're talking about something here, if a person already has a schizophrenia, if they already have a psychiatric disorder, and they get a hold of this and don't have a guide, or the guide is inept, there could potentially be really adverse consequences. Now, what they said back, what the man said back in the 60s when they were getting this stuff, 70s and the 80s, when they were legislating against it and making it illegal, you know, they said it acid could lead to chromosome damage. I remember that one, that trope from the 60s. I guess we didn't need the internet to have bad facts at our disposal back then. They are not addictive. And there's been many studies that establish that LSD and psilocybin are not addictive and that very, very high doses cause no organ damage. So those tropes, let's blast them, kapow, kapow, poof, they're gone. As far as the cardiac effects, there's been steady accumulation of encouraging data. Gradually, because there are several centers now, NYU's Langone Health, there's a couple of other places that are doing psychedelic medicine. And so we're starting to accumulate data. Suddenly, there's a lot of money out there. I think Dr. Doblin has been very careful about who he takes money from. And MAPS has enough money to continue to do high-quality work. We've also got Johns Hopkins, Yale, UC Berkeley, Mount Sinai, that have all recently established psychedelic research divisions, or and all with financing from private donors, which hopefully doesn't mean equity capital. People looking for return on money on this should be returned to the curb, in my opinion. It's interesting to see who's donating here. They're all over the political spectrum, including a woman named Rebecca Mercer, who, if you're a Republican political operative, you take her calls, and David Broner. David Broner is the child of the liquid soap company, Dr. Broner's. I'm a happy fan of that particular company. So the point is, all over the political spectrum, everybody is interested in this, and they're interested in it because it is a breakthrough. There's a Canadian company that trades on the New York Stock Exchange called Field Trip Health, and they've got dozens of high-end ketamine clinics, LA, Chicago, Houston, and then there's a NASDAQ-listed company called Compass Pathways that is, they've got $240 million, and they're doing 22 clinical trials across 10 countries on the planet looking at psilocybin therapy for treatment-resistant depression. And of course, politics has been changing as well. Oregon became the first state to legalize therapeutic use of psilocybin in 2019, I think. Denver, Oakland, California, and Washington, D.C. have all decriminalized it. And up there in Sacramento, they're thinking it over. You know, they don't want to be late to the party. And the Justice Department has basically taken a hands-off approach because, I believe, it's been contained and it's been wrapped in the flag of science, which is firmly where I want to see it kept. I don't want to see this getting out and being a street drug. I really, really don't, because that is what caused the backlash. These drugs were around, I believe, the late 40s, maybe even earlier. They were being used in research in the 1950s. And in fact, famous clown car driver Ken Kesey was instrumental in popularizing the whole tune in, turn on, drop out movement. And that freaked out the man in a major way. There was a lot of stuff going on to freak out the man in the 60s. But the idea, these agents causing people to think differently about the very highly hierarchical social organization and, you know, go off and build themselves a cabin, that really, really didn't bode well for the economy. I guess that's why they panicked. So there's been an emergency ban on MDMA since 1985, which I think I practically hadn't even heard of it much before that. Of course, I was a pre-med student and then a med student, so I didn't get out much. Nevertheless, my point is they've been slapping this stuff down as soon as they can, and now they seem to have stopped. And psilocybin has applications for smoking cessation. It has applications for spiritual exploration. I imagine that I can definitely see people of a religious nature or a spiritual nature using it to get more in tune with the universe. It seems to work well for depression associated with Alzheimer's disease, which was news to me until I saw this article. Basically, psilocybin, DMT, LSD can help people feel more tolerance, understanding, and empathy. And they induce neuroplasticity, which is the brain's ability to change and reorganize thought patterns, to hear your thought patterns effectively and realize that they're deluded and that you're giving yourself a message that isn't true. That's really the purpose of all psychotherapy, but it's very hard to get people there. This helps it work much faster. So whether you wear eyeshades and listen to Tibetan chanting, as in the Field Trip Health Clinic in Midtown Manhattan, there are guides who talk you through and help people work on their goals. And ketamine doesn't seem to last as well as the psilocybin. But Field Trip, that Canadian company that's already got offices, they're excited and they have a new drug. Well, wasn't that a song? Their new drug is based on psilocybin. It's a short-acting psychedelic, so it works in about half the time, only 2 to 3 hours. So guess what? That would reduce staffing costs of supervised sessions. And of course, not to mention, this is patentable because it's not a natural substance. So if that one gets through, we can imagine, in fact, it's sure to be true that other biotech companies are already smelling the smell of the winds of change, shall we say, and moving to get into mental health services, possibly with a product or a series of products that work a lot better than our current ones. It's got to be done carefully. I can't emphasize that. We have to do it carefully. We need to avoid that backlash phenomenon that I already talked about. And I believe that we could have a serious, serious sea change in the way mental health is managed if we move through with this, if we move forward with this. I'm very, very excited about it. We're going to go to email from Dan in Temecula. This will be a fairly quick one. Dan writes, are wide QRS or premature ventricular contractions a problem? And Dan, that's an excellent question. And so annoying, my answer. It depends. Yes. Most of the time, no. Particularly in the case of premature ventricular contractions. Now, the heart has a pacemaker, and then it has a backup pacemaker. But actually, every single muscle cell in the heart is capable of being a pacemaker in a pinch. The difference is that they're tuned to pace at a different level. So the SA node, which is up there in your right atrium, that is the fastest one. And it's beating at 60 to 100 beats per minute. And that's when you're not exercising. And then if you're exercising, it'll beat faster because it receives stimulation from a number of sources. And the brain is one of them. The level of acid in your blood, because if you're exercising, your muscles will tend to produce more acid. The CO2 levels, all sorts of things trigger a faster heartbeat. And so what's going on there is if the SA node is offline for any reason, perhaps a heart attack right at its area or a blow to the heart from a steering wheel, we'll often see cardiac arrhythmias in that circumstance. The other muscle cells can actually start beating or steal, if you will, the control and beat perhaps a little bit faster. That's usually due to a short circuit, or beat slower. That's usually when the backup pacemaker is actually working. But there are a lot of things that can happen with the heart. Once we get down to the ventricle, those cells are not supposed to be beating except in an extreme situation. So a premature ventricular contraction means one of the ventricular cells has decided, hell with it, I'm just going to beat. Fortunately, they usually can't keep beating fast enough to avoid having the steering wheel wrested back by the SA node and things revert. So in most situations, you'll have one premature ventricular contraction, and then you'll have a little pause. And during that pause, the heart has just another second, half a second to fill. So it fills a little fuller. And so when it pumps, you detect the surge. So when people have palpitations, they usually, when they're ventricular, they don't feel the extra beat, the early beat. They feel the late beat, which is actually normal, but the heart's gotten fuller. And so that pounding you get when you're exercising, that's the pounding of a full heart versus a semi-full heart. Because you're pushing more blood through, you're getting more back to the heart, the pump is working harder. That's a PVC. And generally, they are not a problem. If something is making the heart irritable, perhaps your potassium is off, or your calcium is off, or the pH in your blood is off, or you've taken a drug that causes irritability, or part of that ventricle isn't getting a good blood supply, so it's irritable because it can't breathe. In those circumstances, you'll get lots of PVCs, and that is a sign that you need to look at the vasculature. This is particularly important if we see them after a person is exercised, because that's the circumstance where the heart's most likely to have an area that's oxygen deprived or blood deprived. And so when we see a lot of post-exercise PVCs, we generally want to scratch that surface a little bit and look underneath. So they can be a problem. We also see after a heart attack, back in the day when we didn't have a whole lot of drugs and we didn't have stents and we didn't have bypasses readily available, we saw a lot of heart attacks. And after a heart attack, you could see lots and lots of premature ventricular contractions, and sometimes those could lead to a lethal arrhythmia. So we actually drug them. Now, a wide QRS is a completely different matter. A wide QRS is a situation where the actual image, if you think about the EKG image that we've all seen with the double spiky thing, that's the QRS complex. The QRS is supposed to be up, down, up. When you don't see that where you're supposed to see it, you're worried. If you see the right pattern, but it's just stretched out a little bit, then what that means is generally that there's a problem with the conduction of the heart. So one side of the heart is going down. The signal, you know, that I mentioned from the pacemaker, well, it has to split in two to hit both the right and the left ventricle. And if it travels down the right channel a little faster, then we call that a left bundle branch block. If it travels down the right channel a little slower, we call that a right bundle branch block. And those can be a sign of cardiovascular disease, but they're often a benign sign of aging. Other causes of wide QRS include electrolyte abnormalities. So there are certain situations when we see that we can see it when people have a congenital defect in their heart that affects conduction, and we can sometimes see it under other circumstances. So like I said, probably an exhausting answer, but it depends. So I want to remind you, you can call in to 900-5773, and I'd love to hear anyone who wants to talk about the earlier topic, particularly the personal life-transforming experience with psychedelics. I know you're out there, or you have an opinion that this should be kept in the bottle, or maybe that we should open up the bottle and release it to the winds. I know there's people in England who are saying that we should just put statins in the water supply to reduce cardiovascular disease. Fortunately, they didn't do that. I don't really want to see anybody put psychedelics in the water supply either. It looks like we might have a caller.
Okay. Hello. Yes.
I read the Michael Pollan book about changing your mind, and I thought it was fascinating, and I would like to see it in more of a clinical and for the layperson to do whatever they want. But I just wanted to comment that I don't know if it was with K-Squid or KZU that I've been hearing an ad that hospice is going to do a workshop with that. I don't know if you saw that.
I didn't see that, but I will tell you that.
I went on their website,
yeah,
and I just can't find it, any information on it. But it sounds like pretty soon this weekend or maybe next weekend they're going to do a workshop on end of life with heavy duty sessions of psychedelics. So,
well, you know, I have read about
fear of dying after that, you know. So,
yeah. Be at peace with the universe, feel that connection. It makes sense.
So the reason I was calling was I've had a couple of friends and clients recommend The End of Alzheimer's by Dale
Bredesen.
And it's just fascinating to me. And I don't know if you have gotten into it and the whole getting into the, not a colonoscopy, but a cognitive oscopy. Mm-hmm. Doing that test, or do you do that with your patients, or that
right.
protocol?
Well,
I just think it's fascinating. I think this is much more important than doing a colonoscopy. So I just wonder if you could speak to that.
Yes, of course. Well, stay on the line for a moment, Barbara, in case you have any follow-up questions. I did do, Dale Bredesen actually offers a course for physicians, and so I did go through that course, and it's a pretty extensive training to how to implement his ideas, and it's called the RECODE, like we're recoding the brain. But really what we're doing in this work is we're identifying effectively three different kinds of, let's call them fires or smoldering burns in the brain, things that are damaging the brain. The first one is the toxic type, and this is heavy metal poisoning, people who've had lead or mercury poisoning, other types of poisoning, people who have problems with detoxification, or just, you know, a big body burden of stuff. A lot of people who work in mines or battery factories have issues with Parkinson's, Alzheimer's. Clearly, these are neurotoxins. There's also the diabetes. There's a type 3 diabetes, which is basically diabetes-related dementia. And essentially, just like effectively with heart disease as well, uncontrolled diabetes jumps your age by about 10 years. So you start getting demented at... If it's in the cards that you would get to cognitive issues at 73, then you're going to get them at 63 while you're still working if you're an uncontrolled diabetic. And of course, this is on the average. This is not, you know, like prescriptive, but it's real. And then the people who have the genetics that cause inflammation in their brain from another source, and that's where the one of the quote unquote Alzheimer's genes is the APOE4 gene, which is interesting because it actually makes you a better caveman. It makes you able to heal infections. It makes you able to fight off disease more effectively. But that's because you have a stronger inflammatory response. So as we saw with COVID, a stronger inflammatory response can backfire. And that's kind of what happens in this type of Alzheimer's. So there's 35 or 40 different things that you look at to try and see what's going on in this individual. And there are imaging studies, probably the NeuroQuant, where you measure the size of the hippocampus, is the one that's most available locally. You can get that down in Monterey, and you can get it over in Los Gatos. I don't think Dominican is doing it yet, but it's a modified product that measures the hippocampus in a way that is pretty reliable, and they have, I should put this, benchmark data by age. So if your hippocampus is 2 standard deviations below the size for your age, you want to get on the train and start changing your lifestyle, changing your diet, maybe getting rid of the heavy metals through some sort of safe method, depending on what else we find that seems to be driving it. Obviously, you can't change your DNA, but as I'll be talking about later in this program, DNA is not destiny. It's tendency, and you can change your tendencies. So that's our quick download on it. I do that with patients. There are several levels because you're asking people in the second 50 years of their lives to actually change their behavior. It's extremely difficult. I think the centers, having done this for several years, I would say that it takes a very motivated individual with high discipline to do it on their own. Even with support, it's extremely difficult, particularly if there's family dynamics that don't want to change. And ultimately, the person really has to change what they're doing, and there are spectacular results that are published, scientific journal results for this method. And we still don't have a drug that's worth a damn for Alzheimer's. So behavior change, ketogenic diet, all those things do make a demonstrable difference, in my opinion.
Great. Thank you.
All right, Barb. Thank you very much for the call. Have a great afternoon.
A personal disclaimer. During this program, after I had discussed the therapeutic use of psychedelics, and in particular MDMA for post-traumatic stress disorder, I solicited the audience to call in with their experiences about psychedelics. I've included this gentleman's discussion in particular because I wanted the audience to understand what a difficult lift it is politically to get these things approved, particularly for general public use, which I do not personally agree with. This is in no way intended as advocacy for general recreational use of psychedelic agents. I believe they are better left to a expert therapeutic setting for distinct psychiatric conditions.
Let's go now to Michael in Aptos. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Dr. Dawn. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you today?
I'm pretty good, and I'm listening to your show, and you touched on a couple of subjects that I have some great experience with, although I'm sad not to catch the full talk about what you started when I first came off. You were talking about things of, I believe you pronounced MDMA and psilocybin and other hallucinogenics, which I have great experience with on a personal level.
Mm-hmm.
And I can definitely say that I see some really great positive benefits to any of these substances used in a proper setting, meaning not a dried, sterile clinical study and not some freak on the street that's going to get you high, quote unquote. But I could see there's a lot of benefits to having these certain substances used for people. I believe you called it MDMA, which I believe the street term would be ecstasy.
Yes, although there's some ecstasy that's got other things in it, so we avoid the term.
Okay, well, I won't use the term, but I have had experience with MDMA from a connection I had many years ago that was something that was actually pharmaceutical grade. And upon ingesting it and going to Grateful Dead concerts and having a wonderful time dancing, I have to say I thought it was a wonderful thing for people who were very depressed, people who were suicidal, people who were alcoholics. And I also felt that under right guidance, it could be a wonderful, wonderful tool to really help people out of their funk. I've noticed, seen studies about it, and I think it's a wonderful thing, along with the natural, bear with me, the natural psilocybin. Please forgive me, I'm a street guy.
Psilocybin.
Peyote. Mm-hmm. Okay, psilocybin. I got new dentures, what can I say? Once again, those are substances that are natural, and you have to work with the archetypes who rule those substances, so to speak, the energies behind that. I think they're wonderful. What's nice about those is that if you get two out there, you can always eat and it'll settle you down. One I'm even more familiar with and I liked taking was the one that we used to call LSD or acid, because I'm not that old, and so I couldn't say I actually had the original formula way back when. But just to touch base briefly with that, because what my experience is, and I was very blessed to be with people who were friendly and kind, and like I said, I'm an old deadhead, so I was with people who were wanting to be nice and cool. And in the right circumstances, it gives you a whole different perspective, and just a different way of being present with yourself when this is a good idea.
I think context is extremely important. I agree.
Oh, definitely. But I think it's definitely something that could really help people out. I just hate to see it just like tossed out there and say go for it, or being put on something that was too dry and too antiseptic, so to speak, in that kind of frame. So, no, it's just something, if you have somebody with some background and could take people on these little journeys and get them to lighten up in that more better setting than pumping them through antidepressants, I think it's a blessing, and I think it should be used.
Thank you, Michael. I appreciate your perspective. One last question for you. Did you ever experience what you would call a life-transforming event or trip?
I wanted to get to why I really called you, but okay. My life, let's see, which one would have been? I'm going to be old man now. Way back in 1983, Someone introduced me to something, okay, street terms, something that was called purple microdot mescaline. And I bought a couple of them, shared it with some friends of mine. And I'd say it took us throughout the whole evening, the nighttime, the morning. And I realized that what I was being shown as a child growing up and what was really out there wasn't different. It's just that we're showing this very limited, very small, like looking for a little pinhole of what life is or what life in the universe and existence really is. And for a brief couple hours, I was, someone opened the door and said, take a look at this, and slammed the door real close. And it was in a blink of an eye, you can see so much, but once again, you're back to where you were before. How do you interpret that flash of everything you saw? With me being leaning already towards that hippie-ish nostalgicism, I saw that, and that's the direction I went with it. I said, this is very wonderful. These people, this is where I want to go in my life, and it's where it expanded me, where the things I've been taught is very limiting, where I could say, I kind of feel that I don't want to put anybody's beliefs down, but it seemed to me that everything I was shown and everything I've seen other people focusing on was so narrow. Was like, but we're living in an age where
the final Michael, I'm gonna stop you now and just say what I'm gonna boil down what you said for the audience and just say it. Okay. It broke you out of your box. It gave you that neuroplasticity. It allowed you to change your programming. And that's, I think, the thank you so much for calling and sharing that with us, because it really does speak to the whole concept here. Thanks for calling. I'm going to sign off now. And please keep listening.
Thank you. And I'll send you an email of what I was actually going to ask you.
All right. Fair enough. And we'll cover it next week.
All right, bye.
Well, we had some wonderful calls, and we have a couple of more wonderful emails. So I'm going to make the institutional complicated thing will be all genetics all the time next week. We'll just push that forward a bit. I love the free form here. That's we have the freedom to not do what the TV, what we said we were going to do in the TV guide. Oh, boy, does that date me, right? Anyway, let's go to Shaul in Israel, who is a regular writer. Shaul writes, I'm a 74-year-old male, thin and healthy. And does CoQ10 decline with age? And do you recommend taking supplements? And if so, what doses? And also, the same meal, this is a YouTube video, the same meal eaten at the wrong time of day can double blood sugars. Is it true? And there was a link to an article. And so I'm going to cover that one first and just say that the title of the article is silly and the science is silly. But the answer to your question, Shaul, is yes, it does make a difference when you eat what you eat. Deleterious effects of omitting breakfast on insulin sensitivity and fasting lipid profiles in healthy, lean women. Now, the reason I say the study was silly was that they said they were trying to figure out whether eating breakfast or omitting breakfast would affect energy intake and circulating insulin and a whole bunch of parameters. And so in the eating breakfast, they gave them breakfast cereal with 2% milk. That's a lot of carbs at 8 a.m. and then a cookie at 10:30. And in the no breakfast, they got the cookie between 10:30 and the cereal and milk at noon. And then they ate four more meals that were pretty much predetermined content. And then they measured their lipids and their glucose levels and their LDL, and everything was worse in the omitting breakfast group. Well, yeah, because they started with a cookie. Let me clue you into something, Shaul. You gotta eat protein at breakfast. And skipping breakfast is a problem only if the first thing you eat is carb. If you delay your breakfast, let's say till 11 o'clock, and what you eat is a high protein meal, you will not have adverse effects on any of the parameters. They designed the study to get their results so they could get published. I do not think this is good science. A good science would have looked at a protein eaten at the same time and a car and their control breakfast, cornflakes and milk, eaten at the same time, and they would have found what I just said, much better results. Your body is insulin resistant in the morning. It wants protein. Give it to it. You'll eat more carbohydrate throughout the day if the first thing you eat is carbohydrate. So if you're trying to lose weight, the first thing you eat needs to be protein. Now, the other issue that Saul had, and let me check my time, is about CoQ10. And CoQ10 is a very important antioxidant. It's the only fat-soluble antioxidant that the human body makes, and it is everywhere. In fact, its other name is ubiquinol because it is ubiquitous, and it is a key factor in mitochondrial generation of ATP, your basic energy currency. It's part of the basic process of life. So yeah, it's important. It's also in the membranes of the mitochondria, and it grabs up free radicals. So it is really, really crazy important. Yes, you should take it as we age. In fact, starting at the age of 20, we make less of it. You should take it how much? I generally recommend for a healthy elder like yourself, 100 milligrams. It's been shown to be safe at levels of up to 700 daily forever. And it's been used at levels grams, that is to say, 1 or 2,000 in the treatment of Parkinson's disease in some small studies without any obvious adverse events. But children, don't try that at home. Looks like we have a caller, Lean.
Yes, hello, dear doctor.
Hello.
I've called a long time ago, and I happily listen most every week.
My dear, we only have about 5 minutes, so...
Well, just a minute to say that... back in 1971, and my howdy-doody generation of experimenting with sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and my psychedelic experience going through Death Valley. And it was, I felt like I was on another planet. And, but I was conscious of being, of this being an illusion. And then we got to Las Vegas, and I felt like I was a being from another planet visiting Earth. It was so strange.
Oh, my, yes.
Just
that Hunter S. Thompson book, Fear and Loathing.
But I must say that for most people on psychedelics that you do, it takes people back to a childhood state.
Mm-hmm.
It really does.
Was that pleasant and transformational for you?
Oh, not transformational, but it was certainly fun. And in a child ego state, I had no desire. Cigarettes were horrible to try to smoke, and it was quite an experience I'll always remember.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that with us.
And but the very, very first time was in De La Vega Park, and somebody had spiked the apple juice.
Oh.
And I was fine. I was a little girl, and I said, where's everybody going? Why do we have to go? I was with my hippy-dippy friends. Come on, we have to leave. Why? I'm having a great time. And part of the not real hallucinations as such, but... trees, the vegetation was, I felt like I could see them breathing. See the vegetation. A lot of people have experienced that. Okay.
Wow. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for your wonderful show.
Thank you.
We got an email from David. I have just enough chance to read and answer. Please comment on SSRI drug development versus the current designer psychoactive compounds, MDMA, psilocybin DMT. Are the SSRI class of drugs watered down class of older natural extracts found in plants? And actually, no, David, the SSRI class for the most part are new to nature molecules, and they are inhibitors of the reuptake of serotonin. That's hence the name, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. I know of no plant class. The plant classes that we think about St. John's wort, which is a natural antidepressant, is actually an MAO inhibitor. It's a completely different enzyme that breaks down dopamine, epinephrine, and serotonin. So it causes stuff to hang around longer, but it's a completely different molecule with a completely different set of behaviors. It really is a different animal. I hope that answers your question. And I want to thank all of the people who took the effort to reach us by phone. And I want to thank Shaul and, in Israel, and invite you all to come back next week and listen more. We're going to be talking about genetics. We're going to be talking about systemic inertia, and also the see no evil approach of institutional science. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long, stay safe, and stay healthy. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Bansky. Music by John Scoville.